Welcome to the Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this May 3rd, 2011 on the West Coast, now May the 4th, 2011 on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. I'd like to also welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network. I may have neglected to acknowledge you folks last night, so make up for it right up front. Glad you can tune in. I think everyone is going to find this show very, very interesting. I'm going to breach a topic that's normally taboo, and although it's been written about and speculated and even victimized by disinformation and let's say superstition and more disinformation, I'm going to be revealing some truths. All of it is not going to come out on this show tonight. It's just impossible to cover all the material that I want to cover, but I will be doing a sequel to this tonight's show on this coming Thursday. So be sure to tune in. And this is not a tease when I say that. It's just impossible to cover all of it unless they want to let me stay on the air for 4, 5, or 6 hours tonight. I'll do it all tonight. What am I talking about? Well, I've been reporting my research findings from show to show over the past nearly 4 years, sharing that research with you through the articles that I wrote for the Idaho Observer, as well as on my website, directlightproductions.com. And I've been fortunate to also have other websites that link to my work and even post some of the archives from my shows. Kanadachi's educate-yourself.org is one such place. And so I'm grateful for the help that I get from people that do know the truth, people that are in search of the truth and are, like myself, messengers of the truth. I'm just the messenger. Occasionally, one's life experiences intersect things that have been written, and the story that I'm going to be sharing with you tonight and on future shows is one of these events. In fact, reviewing something that I had read some time ago, just suddenly triggered in my being, and I realized that I knew who was being talked about in the investigative portion of the story that we're going to be delving into. And this dovetails with everything that I've been saying about what is really at the bottom of what's going on this planet. Who's pulling the strings? Why? And why those who reveal these truths are ridiculed, even murdered, because the truth to those who are covering it or putting it behind a veil don't want these things to be known, because it will reveal an enormous amount of fraud and the intention to take over this planet, to enslave everyone on the planet. Now, you can see this happening just in the U.S. government. You don't have to think about beings coming from other parts of the universe to visit the Earth to know that governments are oppressive on this planet. And the knowledge of what is going on will lead you to the wisdom to discover who you truly are and why you're here, and it will give you a tremendous amount of power in dealing with the issues that we face today. So as a messenger, that's my message. Plain and simple, is to enlighten people as to what the truth is about many topics that have been obscured from history, twisted, spun, laundered, like the money that they use to accomplish these goals. And we're going to get down to the bottom of the big secret. This isn't necessarily the big secret or the biggest secret that David Icke wrote about, but it certainly dovetails with that topic. Many authors, many researchers, many journalists, essayists, even people who have worked for the government know these truths to some extent. And I think you're going to find it interesting when we look at one person's life. And it was a rather short life, considering some of his accomplishments and what would have been behind his demise. Before we go into that, however, we are going to approach this in a sense of spirit. Dare I call it the spirit of the West. Thank you. Such foreboding music. Spirit of the West by Yellow Jackets from their album Club Nocturne. Well, tonight's topic is going to be a recitation of a piece that I did not write. Some of my research is along these lines, however, and it was composed by an individual using the pen name The Magician. The piece is called Jack Parsons and the Curious Origins of the American Space Program. I'm going to be reading, first of all, part one, Hermes, the Ontological Detective. I first heard about Jack Parsons from a fellow named Homer Nilmont back in Philadelphia around 1987. That was the time of my aborted attempt to get out of stockbroking and make a living as a private detective. I can't tell you who Homer Nilmont was or what I did for him, but I can tell you what I found out about Jack Parsons. All the stories, sources here are real. Look them up for yourself, but be forewarned that your view of how the world works may never be the same again. Mine hasn't been. Homer Nilmont was holding the folder close to his chest as though fearful I might make a grab for it. The label read, Pasadena. Mythological control, he said. The myth makes the man. Lyndon Johnson used to say that about that old windbag, Hubert Humphrey. I've got his pecker in my pocket. Well, you get hold their mixed up little minds and you've got their peckers and a lot more. We were setting at an open air table at Downey's at the end of South Street in Philadelphia. He had been rambling for an hour, feeling me out or perhaps just putting on a show. He would come to the point eventually. I looked out across Front Street to the Delaware and the barge being towed upriver. A jogger trotted past in the direction of the Ben Franklin Bridge. Them endorphin addicts can't even get enough, he observed, nodding at the jogger. How'd you vote last election, he added as an afterthought. I voted for Clint Eastwood. We didn't find any record you registered. He enunciated registered carefully, with hardly a trace of Texas accent. Clint didn't run last election. You a Republican, Democrat, Shiite on a shingle, what? Fair enough, it was his money. He could ask what he wanted, and I would prevaricate when necessary. I presumed he already knew the answers to the questions he was asking. He was just measuring my responses against what he already knew. I'm a Sunni in a Subaru, I said. I'm a libertarian. I don't think it's any of the government's business how I spend my money or who I go to bed with. The first makes liberals apoplectic, and the other raises self-righteous indignation in neoconservatives. I say a pox on both their houses, and yours too, I thought. You gonna vote for Russell Means and Ron Paul? I played along. Gorbachev says he's a Democrat. Doesn't mean he'll carry Chicago. The Libertarian Party has about as much to do with libertarianism as the president of Coca-Cola has to do with the cocaine trade. The connection is at best historical and etymological, and these are differences in marketing. I added, of course, some people who snort the one also like to drink the other. Anyway, Means and Paul aren't running together. They're competitors, at least until the party caucus. Paul was a Republican until recently. And Means was an engine, he said. On the other hand, anyone who calls the IRS the Gestapo has got my sympathetic attention. He reflected on this, then, ever hear of Jack Parsons? Jack Parsons? He and a feller named Theodore von Karman started the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. You know, those Jupiter probes and all that. I've heard of von Karman, I said. If the data doesn't fit your theory, take logs. And if that doesn't work, take logs, logs, and then the data will fit any theory whatsoever. Homer looked at me suspiciously. Just something I read in grad school, I said. Von Karman said that, according to Granger and Morgenstern in a book about stock market prices. What about Parsons? Parsons died in the 50s. We want you to find out who killed him. Parsons was murdered? It was alleged an accident. We have reason to think differently. Here are some clippings about the death. You can read them later. Could I ask why I asked taking the envelope? Why he was murdered? That's what you're to find out. Why you're interested in Jack Parsons. Maybe later. Now it's best if you just look into without any prejudice. It was the summer of 87, and if the end was nigh, it was not nigh enough to notice. The 7 years of plenty were symbolized by Merrill Lynch's theriomorphic Serapis. The country was high on money, congressional soap operas, and impending doom. The apocalypse, heralded by books like The Great Depression of 1990 and Blood in the Streets, made all the sweeter the preceding spasm, the 20th century's last great money-making opportunity. In accordance with Elliott Wave V, an exuberant public mood was lifting stock prices and women's skirts. Or at least that's what I had said in my last report. It was a study for an investment bank on the correlation between stock market prices and trends in popular culture. A golden opportunity for theriomorphic BS. I strolled up South Street on the way back to the office. The designer punk mirrored the cracks in the zeitgeist. It was a rebellion of nostalgia. The Beatles, a bull market band, were back in vogue. Aging yuppies saw a new puberty, but not with cash to follow their noses. I had just read an article written for Rolling Stone by P.J. O'Rourke, the famed author of How to Drive Fast on Drugs While Getting Your Wing-Wang Squeezed and Not Spill Your Drink. He was sufficiently smitten by déjà vu to recommend LSD. Let the 60s die. To an ontological detective like myself, it seemed he had nothing to fear. It was the death of the 80s that worried me. My office was located in a renovated girls' school on Christian Street. It was non-obtrusive, inexpensive, with plenty of room for files. Anyway, I never met clients there. The electronic gate was intended to prevent car theft, but it kept visitors out, too. Sherry, my assistant, was reading a book. Sherry was a member of the Church of the Subgenius and had a picture of Bob tacked to the wall behind her. Bob was smiling with his customary pipe clenched between his teeth. There was also a poster advertising Gimme Slack, the recent hit single by Doctors for Bob. Sherry was devoted to Frop, which she discreetly kept out of sight in the lower left-hand desk drawer. "Herm, listen to this," she said. "This was the most popular book in America before the American Revolution. You'll enjoy this. Here's the description of some of those who get smashed by the Prince of Peace when he returns one day, all unexpectedly." She quoted, "Adulterers and whoremongers were there and all unchaste. They're covetous and ravenous. The riches got too fast. Who us vile ways themselves to raise to states and worldly wealth, oppression by or knavery, by force or fraud or stealth? No corporate raiders in the kingdom," I asked. "Nor much of anyone else," Sherry said. "Listen to these virtuous types." Then were brought nigh a company of civil, honest men. The loved true dealing and hated stealing ne'er wronged their brethren, who pleaded thus, "Thou knowest us, that we were blameless livers. Our way was fair, our dealing square, we were no wasteful spenders, no lewd tosspots, no drunken sots, no scandalous offenders." Sound like Philadelphians to me. not your average lewd tosspots. I would guess a Caribbean island, a legion of angels, a long vacation for each, not to mention blessedness and glory. Wrong, Hermes, she said. They get cash into hell along with the others. They had the wrong attitude. They were just noble because they wanted a reputation for virtue and honesty. It was all an ego trip. Hard man, that Jesus. If this was the most popular book around at the time of the Revolution, it makes you wonder how business ever became the business of America, much less how we arose out of the swamp to sign the Bill of Rights. The founding fathers were mostly deists, Sherry said, shifting to professorial mode. They didn't believe in this God's wrath nonsense. They thought religion was something naturally inborn, which made them oppose crimes committed in the name of God, revelation, or the church. Tom Jefferson and his free-thinking dinners. Sherry paused to grin at her own little speech. Makes you proud to be an American, she laughed. The book was entitled The Day of Doom, or A Poetical Description of the Great and Last Judgment, with a short discourse about eternity, by one Michael Wigglesworth of Harvard University. It was first published in 1662. It would seem Wigglesworth was playing the classic guilt game. I suggested, if you cheat, your methods are evil, and if you're honest, your attitude is evil. Everything you do is wrong. You're inherently defective, and you had better do what the guru says. Yeah, these cults are all alike, Sherry said. They want to wash your brain with a filthy Brillo pad. Speaking of which, two pink boys were here earlier. They wanted to ask you some questions. They looked like Zist agents to me, but were dressed somewhat better than that. Sherry called all government employees Zist agents. They got through the gate, I asked. The only door to the office opened directly into the parking lot with its surrounding fence. They followed someone in, or maybe they flew by Phantom helicopter. They could have been the three men in black, except there were only two of them. One of them was a fat little fellow, greasy black hair, smooth talker. The other was medium build, skinny face, pasty, like he had just climbed out of a cemetery. I told them you had gone to New York on business and we would be back in a week. I didn't know what hotel. You never tell me anything. They left a number for you to call. I took the phone number and went into my office. The first thing I wanted to do was read the clippings on Jack Parsons that Homer Nilmont had given me. I leaned back in my chair, put my feet on the desk, and looked out the window. The construction debris across the street didn't keep my attention for long, so I opened up the envelope. The first article was from the late news edition of the Los Angeles Times, Wednesday, June 18, 1952. The banner headline on the front page read, "Rocket Scientist Killed in Pasadena Explosion. Tragedy Drives His Mother to Suicide. Cripple is Helpless Eyewitness." A brilliant Pasadena rocket propulsion expert met death in an explosion that ripped his garage laboratory yesterday, and as a tragic aftermath, his mother committed suicide by taking sleeping pills while an elderly crippled woman watched helplessly. John W. Parsons, 31, former Caltech scientist and instructor and one of the founders of the school's famed Arroyo Seco Jet Propulsion Laboratory, was killed when two explosions, which occurred almost simultaneously, demolished the laboratory on the grounds of the former Bush estate at 1071 South Orange Grove Avenue, Pasadena. Parsons' mother, Mrs. Ruth Virginia Parsons, 58, of 21 West Glenarm Street, Pasadena, took 45 pills after she was notified of her son's death at the Huntington Memorial Hospital about an hour after the explosion. The two women were in a home at 424 Arroyo Terrace, Pasadena, at the time. Her elderly friend, Mrs. Helen Rowan, a crippled, confined to a chair, saw the woman take the pills from a bottle left on a table after she had taken two capsules on order of a physician. Moments later, another friend, Mrs. Nellie Smith, a nurse, arrived at the home to console Mrs. Parsons in her bereavement. She found her slumped in a chair in the living room and Mrs. Rowan sitting helplessly nearby. Three pills were left in the bottle. Mrs. Nadia Kilbart, 59, of 320 Waverly Drive, Pasadena, was in another room of the house at the time. Mrs. Parsons took the bottle in her hands and began taking the capsules. The mother of the chemist had told Mrs. Kilbart, Mrs. Kilbart, that she couldn't stand it anymore and that she would kill herself, according to Pasadena Police Lieutenant John C. Elliott. He said Mrs. Rowan lived with Mrs. Parsons at the West Glenarm Street address. Parsons was recognized as one of the foremost authorities on rocket propulsion since leaving Caltech in 1946. He had been employed as a consultant by many firms. His brother-in-law, Robert Cameron, 28, of 125 North Rampart Boulevard, told Newsmen. Parsons and Dr. Theodore von Karmin, notice they say von Karmin, had founded the Caltech Jet Laboratory in the Arroyo Seco. The explosives expert was preparing for a trip to Mexico on a job assignment, the nature of which was very secretive, Cameron said. Parsons was last employed by the Burmite Powder Company in Saugus. Parsons was apparently packing bottled explosives in a box to take with him on the trip today when the explosion occurred. It was followed immediately by a second and larger explosion, setting off other explosives stored in the room, according to Lieutenant Elliott. Remnants of bottles marked explosives were found on the floors, walls, doors, partitions. The ceiling and floor of the garage were demolished, and a bathtub was toppled over. The body of Parsons was found lying near the tub. The death of Mrs. Parsons was reported at 9.06 p.m., almost 4 hours after the explosion shattered the made-over garage. Dr. J.H. Huntsman pronounced her dead. He had been summoned by Mrs. Smith, the nurse. Four tenants residing in the building above the garage laboratory were uninjured but were rooted from their apartments. Salvatore Gonzi, an artist who occupies a unit directly above the laboratory, said the blast ripped a large hole in the floor and broke a leg of his grand piano. Army ordnance experts from Fort MacArthur were called to the scene by Pasadena police to inspect the debris and to determine the cause of the blast. They were also to inspect Parsons' temporary residence at 424 Arroyo Seco, home of Mr. and Mrs. Frank Carpenter, who were out of town, for any additional explosives stored there. The building which contained the garage was, at the time, a servant's quarters for the estate and recently had been converted to a multiple unit. The bodies of Parsons and his mother were taken to the Turner Stevens mortuary pending funeral arrangements. I mentally reviewed what I had just read. Parsons was an expert on rocket propulsion. He was active during and immediately after the Second World War. He had had a position at Caltech and was a founder of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He had been working as a consultant for the Burmite Powder Company, according to his brother-in-law. Brother-in-law, no quote from his wife. Where was she? Parsons was preparing to make a trip to Mexico on a secret job assignment. Parsons had stored explosive in his garage. Would an explosives expert do that? An explosion had killed Parsons and demolished the garage, but had not done major damage to the apartment above. The explosion had occurred in two parts. A small explosion had apparently ignited other explosives. By some unknown sequence of events, Parsons had been delivered to Huntington Memorial Hospital and had been pronounced dead. Parsons was unexpectedly young, only 31. Most of the article was about Parsons' mother. She heard the news, took a bottle of sleeping pills, and died while a crippled friend watched. Both deaths had occurred Tuesday, June 17th. The article had been written hurriedly. Von Karman's name was misspelled. There were no quotes from Parsons' colleagues or employers. No quotes from Caltech or JPL or the Army ordnance experts. Second clipping was the next day's follow-up article on Thursday, June 19th. Parsons' age had increased by 6 years, and Burmite had become Burmite. The first spelling with a U, second being an E. Scientists' fatal blast explained. Police theorized last night that the explosion which took the life of John W. Parsons, 37-year-old rocket and jet propulsion expert, in his Pasadena laboratory Tuesday, resulted from his dropping a can of fulminate of mercury. Pasadena police chemist Don M. Harding, completing his examination of the remains of the blast, said it was definitely established that the fulminate of mercury, a sensitive explosive used only as a detonator, was set off by a shock at floor level. Harding said the quantity of fulminate of mercury could not be determined, but he reported that the coffee can, in which Parsons apparently was mixing the batch, was shredded into shrapnel. There was a large quantity of other types of explosives in the laboratory, many of an experimental nature, Harding said. Police said it had been reported that Parsons was manufacturing small quantities of the fulminate of mercury for commercial purposes. The blast on the grounds of the former F.G. Cruikshank estate at 1071 South Orange Grove Avenue, Pasadena, shattered the garage laboratory and inflicted injuries on Parsons that caused his death an hour later. The scientist's mother, Mrs. Ruth Virginia Parsons, 58 of 21 West Glen Arm Street, Pasadena, swallowed 45 sleeping pills and died after hearing of the tragedy. Parsons was identified as one of the nation's leading authorities on explosives and jet propulsion. With five other original shareholders, he founded Aerojet Engineering Corporation in 1942, but sold out his interest 3 years later. He was a loner, recalled T.E. Rehan, secretary treasurer of Aerojet. He liked to wander, but he was one of the top men in the field. Many of the basic patents for JATO, jet-assisted takeoff, were obtained under Parsons' name. While the vice president of Aerojet, he headed the solid propellant development project. Associates said he was not known to have done any work on atomic power. Parsons had been with the Burmite Powder Company of Saugus for a year until last Friday, when he left intending to go to Mexico. There, he told associates, he intended to do further research with explosives and miniature special effects for motion pictures. At the Saugus firm, Parsons headed one of the rocket propellant detonation and pyrotechnic short interval delay projects, a confidential research and development project. He stayed until Friday to finish his project, said J.H. Arnold, treasurer and superintendent of Burmite. I tried to get him to stay for the test, but he was anxious to go to Mexico. He had been working hard. Parsons was extremely safe-conscious, Arnold said. He worked carefully, had a thorough knowledge of his job, and was scrupulously neat, the superintendent recalled. Arnold was surprised that Parsons had explosives in the small makeshift laboratory near his home, a violation of the Pasadena fire ordinance. The superintendent said, however, that Parsons had a powder magazine near Rialto and 6 or 8 months ago had planned to go into the dynamite business. Harding said enough explosives remained in the laboratory to blow up half the block. The explosives had been stored there for 6 months or longer, police learned. Examination of the blast scene disclosed that the explosion was concentrated in a small area. Apparently, Parsons received the full terrible force against his body. A hole was blown through the floor directly under the section upon which Parsons presumably was standing. The blast broke windows in an adjoining estate owned by W.W. Burris, Martin Fauschaug, and his mother, Mrs. Alta, Fosshaug, excuse me, my mispronunciation, Sal Gonsi, an artist, and Joanne Price, a model, were on the floor of the converted barn at the time of the explosion. Everything fell off the walls, Gonsi said. The piano was knocked over, its legs broken. We were staggered. Gonsi said he had expected something to happen as a result of Parsons' preoccupation with explosives. The chemist frequently warned neighbors that his experimental materials were unstable. Harding was so skeptical of the chemicals left, he shielded them from flashbulbs as photographers took pictures. I skimmed some irrelevances. Then, Parsons, it was disclosed, attained his eminence as an explosives expert principally by self-training. Born here, he was graduated from high school but took only 2 years of night study at SC. Although Parsons had no formal degree, he went from SC to Caltech as a research associate in aeronautics and with Dr. Theodore von Karman founded the Caltech Jet Laboratory. He was a member of the American Chemical Society, the Institute of Aeronautical Science, the Army Ordnance Association, and Sigma Xi Fraternity. He had refused a number of honorary degrees. Well, any way you looked at it, Parsons was a remarkable individual. He had become a research associate at Caltech without formal training, establishing himself as one of the foremost experts on jet propulsion, co-founded the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and had also been a founder of Aerojet. He made his own way from nowhere to the top of his field. It was not surprising to find he was a loner. The newsmen's curiosity had been easily satisfied. There were many unanswered questions. Parsons was described by a co-worker as careful and scrupulously neat, yet he had stored explosives for 6 months in a building with four upstairs tenants? Was this uncharacteristic carelessness? The four tenants who lived in the top floor of the converted garage barn were apparently aware of Parsons' laboratory below, yet were content to remain where they were. There were supposedly enough explosives left in the lab to blow up half the block. Was this just police hype? The blast that did occur managed to destroy the floor, ceiling, walls, and door of the lab without setting the other explosive off. There also was a conflict with the first article in which a police lieutenant had described two explosions. Now, according to the second article, there was a single blast from the dropped fulminate of mercury. Again, there were no quotes from Parsons' wife or colleagues at JPL or Caltech. Just brief comments from the company officials at Aerojet and Burmite. Where were the characteristic expressions of grief and admiration for a departed co-worker? Why did Parsons need to go to Mexico to do further explosives research? What was special about Mexico? Or was the trip a cover story to account for time that would be spent elsewhere? These questions were 35 years late. Homer Nilmott needed a professional historian, not a detective. But I had known that from the start it hadn't prevented me from taking the project. Necessity is the mother of pretension. I went over to the sink in the corner of my office and poured some espresso beans into the coffee grinder. I put fresh water into the kettle and turned on the hot plate. It felt good to have a client. Homer was my second. The first had enabled me to rent the office, such as it was. Most of the wall space was covered with bookshelves. Filing cabinets filled the interior. It was a loose-leaf compendium of American fringe beliefs. The collection had started as a hobby arising from a general preoccupation with what people believed and why they believed it. Political beliefs, scientific beliefs, religious beliefs, economic beliefs, these were now my stock and trade. Long ago, I had come to the conclusion that the outliers in the data, the odd items that didn't appear to fit, were the ones that told the real story. At the moment, Sherry was in the outer office combing the ads in obscure publications in search of new material. I had hired her because she was already a walking encyclopedia in certain areas, and she seemed reasonably happy to do the job at not very much pay. I ground the beans into a fine powder, dumped the black dust into the strainer, and poured in hot water. After a minute, I pressed out the grounds, transferred the liquid to a mug labeled Personal Paradigms Incorporated, and added some half and half. When coffee drinking had arrived in Europe in the 17th century, the Catholic Church had dubbed the black brew an evil drug. A prince of Waldeck offered 10 thalers to anyone who denounced a coffee drinker. By contrast, Johann Sebastian Bach, the notorious drug pusher and author of the Coffee Cantata, had written, "Coffee, coffee, how I love its flavor. And if you would win my favor, yes, yes, let me have coffee. Let me have my coffee strong." I was decidedly in the Bachian camp on this issue. Just say no to weak coffee. Under the influence of fresh caffeine, I turned to the last clipping from the Los Angeles Times 2 days later, Saturday, June 21st. Mystery angel enters scientist death blast. Prober's advanced belief someone else handled waste in Parsons' laboratory. Evidence of the careless handling of dangerous explosive waste materials at the scene of last Tuesday's fatal Pasadena explosion yesterday was described by a former associate as completely out of character with the scientific background of John W. Parsons, 37. Who was killed by the blast. George W. Santmyers, Los Angeles chemical engineer associated with Parsons in a Naval Ordnance Department research project since January 1st, said that from the evidence gathered at the scene, 1071 South Orange Grove Avenue, he would have concluded that someone else had put quantities of explosive refuse into exposed trash and garbage containers in the rear of the Pasadena Scientist Laboratory. Don Harding, Pasadena police criminologist, reported finding in the trash can 6 filter papers containing inflammable residue of fulminate of mercury. This is believed to have been the explosive that took Parsons' life. The cans mixed with a content of beer tins and kitchen refuse were nearly collected by Pasadena rubbish trucks. In addition to the filter papers, Harding also found some 500 grams of cordite, an ammunition compound. For Parsons to have disposed of such materials in that manner, Santmyer said, would be in the same category as a highly skilled surgeon to operate with dirty hands. And I knew Parsons as an exceptionally cautious and brilliant scientific researcher. The article went on to say that Parsons would not have tried to hastily dispose of such material at the last minute before his trip, nor would he carry such a hazardous primer in an automobile. Then, at the time of his death, Parsons was definitely on the trail of a completely new explosive substance, far superior to any existing commercial blasting material, Santmyers told police. Rumors that Parsons had been involved in mystic cults some years ago were discounted by Santmyers. Curiouser and curiouser. If Parsons was involved in classified work, it would explain some of the information gaps in the first reports. Facts would be withheld because government secrets were involved. It could also be a PR job. If Parsons had embarrassed the government and his colleagues by sloppy handling of explosives, the introduction of a mystery angel would allow government personnel to save face and maintain the image of scientific impeccability. And the story would hold up if federal investigators had squeezed out the Pasadena police under the guise of official secrecy. On the other hand, Homer Nilmont thought Parsons had been murdered. Who would have had a motive to kill Parsons? I knew where to start and why Homer had hired me. I reread the last line. Rumors of mystic cults discounted. Right. I called Sherry. We have anything on Jack Parsons? He was a jet propulsion expert in Pasadena who was killed in an explosion in his garage laboratory in the early 1950s. He was a member of some cult or another. Sherry thought for a moment. He was a member of Aleister Crowley's Ordo Templi Orientis. I don't know anything about him, but I have definitely heard or read the name in that connection. Crowley. I knew a little bit about Aleister Crowley. He was an English occultist and magician, a Cambridge graduate. He had claimed to put magic on a scientific basis. This was magic in the anthropological sense, not in the stage show sense. Real magic. He spelled it with a K. M-A-G-I-C-K. I recalled that he had also been given a channeled revelation, the Book of the Law, in the early part of the century. Some journalist had called him the wickedest man alive. That had been a piece of journalistic sensationalism, as I recalled, but Crowley was certainly controversial. It would be enough to make Santmyers discount rumors of Parsons' involvement in mystic cults. Here's what we need, I told Sherry. We need anything we have on Crowley that might tell what was going on in California, particularly Pasadena. We also need other sources of information on Parsons. Go over to the University of Penn Library and see if you can find anything on the history of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory or early rocket research at Caltech. Look up material on von Karman. There ought to be some references to Parsons. Also, I added, we want to find out if Crowley had any involvement with intelligence organizations. I doubt that Homer Nilmont is paying money just out of his intellectual curiosity about the early history of rocketry. After Sherry had left on impulse, I pulled out the Encyclopedia Britannica and looked up Aleister Crowley. There was a two-word entry, 20th century Satanist, it said. Well, you could always count on the Encyclopedia Britannica for in-depth research and scholarly impartiality. Satanism, whatever that was a standard term of abuse applied by certain groups to anyone who disagreed with their religious beliefs. Some Protestants called Catholics Satanists. Some Catholics called Masons Satanists. Some termed satanic the adherents of the moon goddess or other nature religions. The encyclopedia might as well have described Jesus as a first century blasphemer based on the gossip of the Sanhedrin. Or maybe Crowley was really some sort of Satanist. In Philadelphia, Satanists were rebellious teenagers from religious homes who tattooed 666 on their bodies and sacrificed small animals, which reminded me of the two men in black. I looked at the phone number left behind Sherry's afternoon visitors. It was a Center City. When I punched in the number, I heard a ring, a click, then a further ring with a different tone. Then the line went dead. I hung up and took a sip of coffee. The phone rang. Personal paradigms, I answered. We know, a voice said. Good afternoon, Mr. Paradigms, said a second voice. May I help you? Yes, said the first voice. Oh, that's very good. He wants to help us, said the second. The first voice continued, we understand you were interested in Jack Parsons, Mr. Paradimes. Is this true? Not at all, I said. That's good. That's very good, said the second voice. Jack Parsons was the cause of much trouble for a lot of people recently, Mr. Paradimes, but it's settled down now. We wouldn't want anyone mixing the pot. Stirring the cauldron, the second voice corrected. Rejuvenating the remains. Rolling the ruckus. Why do you care? I asked. We care. We are very caring people, the second voice said. Who do you work for? Let's just say we work for the government, voice number one. We represent a government agency, voice number two. You will not have heard of us. We keep a low profile, number one. Laughter, number two. That's very good. We keep a low profile with our high foreheads. More laughter. The line went dead. I took another sip of coffee. Leaving the office, Sherry was a blur of motion. She always felt that if she could only move fast enough, the world would spin out behind her like a treadmill. She had the key in the switch of the Volvo while still closing the door with her left hand, starting the electronic gate on its ponderous rise while sliding out of the parking space in a deft parabola, then shot through the opening with barely an inch to spare. She turned right in the direction of Lombard. Holy crowly schmowly, she checked her watch. It was 2:32. She decided she would stop at Harvest by the stock exchange on her way over to campus. Frank would likely be there in a few minutes. Like some of the other foreign currency options traders, he liked to pop up for a beer right after the close. Frank had told her about a psych professor he had who was into Crowley. From 22nd Street, Sherry cut back down Market toward the exchange and slid into a park plots on the street as a car pulled out. The driver in a second car waiting to back into the same space stuck his head out of the window and said, "You bitch," he yelled. Sherry flashed him a smile as she put a quarter in the meter. She entered the exchange building on 20th Street, walked through the atrium past the exchange entrance, and into Harvest. Frank wasn't there, so she sat down and ordered two beers. She was nearly finished with hers before Frank came in with some other traders. Sherry waved him over. I was getting blown out of the water all day by the Swiss franc. Frank took a seat and downed half the beer. In the morning, I was delta neutral, fully hedged, you know, intending just to buy and sell a few and suck out the spread. But then the Swiss started to rally. It ran up 100 points, and I was sitting on negative gamma, so I kept buying spot to stay hedged. I was losing money all the way up, and then it turned around and dropped 200 points. My position kept getting longer the more it dropped, so now I had to sell back in the interbank market all the spot I had just bought at a position loss at that because you couldn't keep the option prices in line. Everyone was yelling and shoving, and I had a splitting headache. I went back in the restroom for some energy, but I was so shook up I spilled most of the Coke on the floor. I wasn't gone more than a few minutes, but when I came back, the Swiss had rallied almost 75 points. And Kinski was yelling at me, where the F word had I been? We had a good hit, and he acts like firing me. And the Swissy closed unchanged. It wasn't a good day, he concluded. Sherry nodded sympathetically. Negative gamma can do that to you. She wondered what it was. You can say that again, Frank agreed. He was off in his own world, staring out at pedestrians on 19th. She leaned forward and ran her fingers lightly along the inside of his left thigh. Been getting any lately, Frank? What? His eyes swung to her and jerked abruptly back into focus. Remind me who that psychology professor was you had at Penn, the one you said was into occult and magical groups. Wilson, David Wilson. Yeah, what about him? You were telling me about an exchange in class one day. He was talking about Aleister Crowley. Crowley, yeah. Wilson gave us a reading assignment in this book about the psychology of possession. I think it was saying that people, like holy rollers, who go into a trance and speak in tongues, or, you know, voodoo rituals that use music and drugs, or people who have certain terrifying experiences in war. There was a common psychology in all these. The psychology of sex, drugs, and rock and roll? Something like that, I guess. Anyway, one day he was talking about Crowley. I think he knew some students on campus who thought Crowley was hot feces. Crowley said something about doing your own thing. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, Sherry prompted. Yeah, he was saying they seemed to think it meant doing whatever the hell they wanted to do. What did he think it meant? He said Crowley meant you should find the one thing you really wanted to do in life and to do that. Find your true will. Don't try to be a frigging accountant when you're really a guitar player at heart. There was this guy that was asking him a number of hostile questions. Someone told me after the class that he, this guy, was a member of a magical group. I don't really know if he was or not. Frank looked out the window, once again lost in thought. Thanks, Frank. Gotta go. Listen, call me sometime. We've got to stop meeting like this. Yeah, he turned momentarily to watch her leave. Strange girl, he thought, but fun. Sort of like foreign currency options. The puzzle was half the pleasure. Sherry returned around 6 with a few items from the library. She said there was a psychology professor at Penn named David Wilson who had the reputation of being something of a Crowley expert. I called his office, but he left for the day. I decided to do the same thing. On the way out, I picked up The Day of Doom from Sherry's desk and paged through it. It was filled with family values. The godly wife conceives no grief, nor can she shed a tear for the sad state of her dear mate when she his doom doth hear. The pious father had now much rather his graceless son should lie in hell with devils for all his evils, burning eternally. Then God most high should injury by sparing him sustain, and doth rejoice to hear Christ's voice, adjudging him to pain. Damned sinners deserve no pity, I said to Sherry. Amnesty International can't help you in hell, she replied. With that, I want to share something with you, which is going to sort of dispel this energy, and I can tell just by the pace of reading this that this document and what I'm going to reveal to you over time is going to take a number of shows, but we are going to dissect and reconstruct not only the murder of Jack Parsons, but speculate on who some individuals who are described within this document by its writer, the magician, pen, or let's say aliases, that actually hide who they are. And I know, I will tell you from firsthand experience, I know who the individual is that is going to be described in a rather strange, cryptic manner, but that if the magician had actually revealed this person's identity, while this person was in the physical body, that the magician most likely would have been targeted and himself murdered. Let's listen to a more abstract version of Over the Rainbow. This is Celtic Woman.
Over the rainbow. that you dare to dream really to come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me. When troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops, that's where
I think that's a beautiful version of that song Harold Arlen composed for the movie The Wizard of Oz. And I think in a very mysterious way, even though the movie itself, the entire concept of scripting what's going on in planet Earth in a fictional movie about the dream state experienced by the film's star, Dorothy Gale, as someone who was hallucinating, actually the adults of this world of the time and for generations to follow have been hoodwinked into accepting, being indoctrinated or programmed into the reality of this story as just pure fiction, when in actuality it describes the machinations of Wall Street, the international banks, the Federal Reserve, and to be brief, we could even say witchcraft, satanic worship, and the subjugation of the U.S. Constitution, not to mention world slavery, because this movie has been translated into many languages and is played around the world and is a favorite. It is a remarkable movie. Kind of interesting how it begins with black and white. And then it shifts during the dream state that Dorothy Gale experiences when she's clobbered on the head by a shutter fluttering in tornadic winds. And she shifts consciousness into an understanding, a gradual awakening to the problem. But does she really, really learn the lesson? She's told by the Good Witch of the North, there's no place like home. There's no place like home, as she taps the heels of her sparkly red slippers together. There is so much magic and so much ritual in that movie, it's off the charts. And yet children are introduced to this film at a very young age while they watch the Munchkins dance around and protest their troll-like or their elf-like wisdom, all the while belying the fact that they too have been enslaved by these mysterious powers controlled by the man behind the veil, the man pulling the levers, which produce lightning bolts and thunder and steam and fear, because the wizard is someone to be feared. He's unseen, the unseen hand. And I submit to you that this story about Jack Parsons, his life's work, his contribution to the space program, and certainly his eventual demise, is contained within the story of the Wizard of Oz, but it even goes further than that, because eventually it encroaches upon the hallowed grounds of the Holy Bible and various denominations of the Christian religion, but it doesn't deal with Christianity exclusively. It transcends that. In fact, it's a direct bridge to satanic worship, satanic sacrifice, and ritualistic murder. The suppression of technology, we hear about quite a bit on Evident Footprints, and you'll hear some of that, as well as you'll hear the darker side of what really is the driving force behind the U.S. Space Agency, otherwise known as NASA, the European Space Agency, the Soviet Space Agency, the Chinese version of the same, and any other country that has taken a peculiar interest in this. You also find out that synchronistically, beyond coincidence, this story delves into the issue of the Dome of the Rock, something that I brought up some weeks ago when a spacecraft visited the Dome of the Rock at the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, Israel, filmed by at least four individuals, recently synchronized films 1, 2, and 4, which are posted on YouTube, depicting an event that actually ties into this story. In some mysterious way, it does. And I can tell you, again, from my own personal experience, there is a character and an aspect of this story that is a head-on collision with my own past and my first near-death experience. 26 years ago, on April 30th of this year, it is not by coincidence that I have stumbled upon this story several times during my life, and I came to return to it again to understand something very profound, and it's going to reveal a lot of truth to the whole world. I've not written the story. I'm just reading it to you. You can find it if you want to go on the internet. Again, the name of the piece is Jack Parsons and the Curious Origins of the American Space Program, authored by a man going by the pen name The Magician. And I think he chose that name a bit in tongue-in-cheek, actually. Now, to save you the trouble, if you don't read, and I've certainly come across many people on the internet that don't like to read. So this archive, which is available at bbsradio.com under Evident Footprints, is available to you. If you haven't subscribed to the archives, do so, because you're going to find over time that this archive is quite valuable. You're going to listen to it while driving in your car or sitting down doing something else. And I may make comments on occasion. I'm not going to just come on the air and read the whole thing, but it was important to start the story from the beginning. It's intriguing. I could start in the middle and still cover the specifics that I would like to reveal to you in a number of ways. But in this regard, it does the individual that conducted this investigation and tediously kept a record of it so he could communicate it in his own way to the rest of the world. I'm just honoring the work that he did. And I find so many synchronicities, not just in my own life, but the life of other researchers with whom I am in frequent contact. Some have even been guests on this radio show. And when we connect the dots, we'll all have traveled the same path. And hopefully, we will have dispelled much of the fear that has been paralyzing and crippling humanity, for one thing. And we'll also know quite a bit about the truth. What is going on today is nothing but smoke and mirrors. And really connects to this in a very deep, profound way. I'll be talking about this topic again this Thursday, as I already mentioned. And I hope you tune in on Thursday, but do tune in to Evident Footprints tomorrow when we'll be featuring Wellness Wednesday and my good friend, Dr. Wayne Pickering. That wraps it up for tonight. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I would like to thank Windtalkers Radio Network for broadcasting the show. Over at BBS Radio tonight, we had Seth Hendrick on the sound. I'd like to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.